Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
It's time for Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, number 76, recorded July 1st, 2010. Secrets of the iPhone 4 antenna. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, where we take you through the last 7 days' worth of computer enthusiast and technology information. I am Ryan Schrout, joined once again by Patrick Norton, our co-host. How are you doing, Patrick?
I'm good, man.
A little tight timing. We got everybody here. We're in the right location. And we have a special guest today with us from a secret location in a bunker way underground somewhere, Anand Shimpi from AnandTech.com. How are you doing? Thanks for coming on the show.
I am doing good. Thanks for having me.
Now, one of the reasons we brought you on, other than we love your personality and we like to see your face on the show every once in a while, is iPhone 4 issues. You've been getting a lot of attention, I think, from an article that you and your, was it Brian?
Yep, Brian Klug.
That did a lot of this work on an iPhone 4 review, where I think what a lot of people have been focusing on the review, which is, again, this is just kind of a portion of it, is some of the discussions and testing you were able to do better than I think anybody else has done so far on this antenna issue. I know Patrick and I talked about it last week and kind of the issue of holding it in a hand and which hand and how you hold it. I think anybody
literally 2 hours after we had that conversation, Steve Jobs is talking about how, yes, it's an issue, and then Apple PR verifies it. But, you know, basically you have the iPhone, you have multiple antennas configured on that stainless steel case, and the little black thing here, if you cross the streams, reality explodes and everyone is killed in the Ghostbusters. In this case, you just have signal. Some people, not everyone, has signal degradation.
Signal, right, what you meant up to say. So I'm curious, Anand, what were your findings really on this? I read the article, but I kind of want to get a synopsis of what your findings were, that it did cause signal problems, but overall the phone was still better performing in that area.
Okay, so first I got to give props out to Brian Klug because he just busted his ass. Wait, can I say ass on?
You can.
The show?
You did. Okay. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
We're good.
yeah, he really worked like crazy the weekend the iPhone 4 came out to really get to the bottom of this. I was actually tied up in Evo 4G testing, so I didn't even start testing until he'd done a lot of the antenna work. And then we just really pushed hard the past few days to get it out there. So let me give you a brief explanation of what's happening. At WWDC, Apple announced they introduced the new iPhone. And so here's the phone here. And let's get this over here. Okay. So this little piece right here is the Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, GPS, all those antennas are over there. And then this piece over here that covers the majority of the phone, that's actually your UMTS. So that's your cellular antenna. Mm-hmm. And the problem comes up, in the majority of phones, you got the little image there. In the majority of phones, the antenna is actually in the lower bottom part of the phone. And if you kind of cover that part of the phone, regardless of what kind of phone it is, 3GS or Nexus One, you attenuate the signal. It'll drop the signal a little bit. The normal amount you'll drop that, depending on how tightly you cup it or where you hold it, we measured between, I'd say, no drop at all and up to like 15 decibels. And that's for a normal phone. Now, with the iPhone 4, Apple moved the antenna physically to the outside of the case, which means that if you do conduct between these two antennas here, you're actually going to attenuate the signal more. So that's a design choice. That's a physical part of the phone. And you do. So if you cup the phone tightly, we measured that it'll drop the signal. We measured about 24.6 dB. It'll drop about 24.6 versus almost 15 dB for the iPhone 3GS and 17 for the Nexus One. So it does drop the signal more if you hold it tightly. compared to those other phones. The reason, and that's to be expected, right? The only way to avoid that is to do one of two things. One, you either put a non-conductive case on it, like Apple's mm-hmm. bumpers, or two, Apple could, I'm guessing, and this is also, this is Brian's theory, that you just deposit a non-conductive material on here. And
duct tape.
Brian's
Livestrong bracelets, electrical tape.
Well, he suggested coating it in the same stuff that Apple actually already deposits on the glass screen. You wouldn't need a lot of it, but just something to that's non-conductive.
Right.
And that would help reduce it. So that's what can be done about that. The reason why it looks like it varies from person to person, the reason why some people say, hey, there's no problem, and other people say there is, actually has to do with the way Apple reports their bars. So these little bars here, you know, you've got no bars all the way up to 5 bars.
Right.
It's a nonlinear scale that Apple uses to determine how many bars is 5, or how strong of a signal equates to 5 bars. So that 5th bar actually spans a range of, but the best signal is about negative 51 dB, and yet you have a little chart there. And then the worst is 91 on that bar. So that, I mean, you get a range of like 40
dB. That's huge. That's
ridiculous. Just on one. And then the remaining bars, the remaining 4 bars, only span a range of something like 13 dB. So if you're, and the reason they do that, and all cell phone makers do this to a certain extent, Apple happens to do it quite a bit. The reason they do that is because everyone thinks that the more bars you have, the better your phone is, the better signal strength you have. So obviously, you know, staying at that 5 bar limit as much as possible is desired. So what happens is if you live very, very close to a tower or you're in a very, very high strength signal location. So take Brian Klug, for example. He lives like literally across the street from a tower. his babies are going to have 4 or 5 arms.
But good cell reception.
Strength. Yeah, he's got great AT&T reception, right? So he's up at that negative 51. So if he cups the phone, it attenuates the signal. It drops that, whatever, 20, 25 dB. But it's still at 5 bars, right? Not a problem. Now, where I live, I appear to be at like the lower end of that 5 bar range, right? So it shows that I have full strength, but I may be closer to, you know, say somewhere in the 90s, right? So I cup the phone, and now since I'm on the borderline of that 5th bar, and since the remaining 4 bars cover such a short range of signal strength values, it'll drop from 5 bars down to 4, 3, 2, 1 very, very quickly.
And, it sounds like once you're in the 4th bar area, you're already in trouble. Because I mean, 40 dB, that's a huge range.
Yeah, correct. So that's, that's basically what it is. Once you're already down to 4 bars, you don't actually have great signal. Now, all of this being said, there's actually like a third component to this, right? The iPhone 4, based on our testing, can actually hold calls, transmit data, do all of that down at negative 113 dB. Which is something the 3GS couldn't really do. So the phone actually does better in low signal strength than the previous phone. It's okay. Just that it has the potential to drop more. You lose more signal strength depending on how you hold it.
But it's more because the antenna is more sensitive, then it's not losing the data or calls quite as frequently.
Yeah, if you are in a position of low signal strength, you're more likely to be able to make a phone call, carry on a conversation, or transmit data on this thing versus the 3GS.
Gotcha.
But based on how you hold it, you're more likely to drop, or you're going to drop more signal on the 4 than you would on the 3GS.
So basically you're saying is raise the pinky.
Yeah.
Hold it with 2 fingers. Do not cross the antennas.
And so Brian would suggest to just get a damn case.
Right.
And like, I'm vehemently opposed to that, right? I'm like, you can't sell
as well,
a product based on styling and then tell you to cover up the styling to fix the product. Like, that's not okay in my book.
I hear what you're saying, but as somebody who went through 2 screens in the space of 3 weeks on their iPhone 3G, I bought the case immediately. And Veronica Belmont's already dropped this phone twice, which actually there's some decent tactile or some stickiness to the case. But right. I'm now officially paranoid, or I should say terrified, to not have a case on my iPhone because
there's
a lot of glass on this thing.
while I was waiting in line, Mark Rain, VP of Epic Games, calls me and he's like, dude, I'm going for a swim, but can you pick me up some cases? So here I am like suffering in line. And I actually left the Apple store with four cases. I still got mine in a box. Like I still can't bring myself to use it. But I agree when you're talking about this thing.
A product really built on, you know, they advertise it as beautiful phone, right? And covering it up. I just kind of have a thing against cases anyway. When you take it in and out of your pocket, you get lint on it and all those kinds of other practical issues. But one interesting thing from this, the topic of this nonlinear scale in the bars is, it sounds to me like the smart thing for Apple would do would be to create or update the software so that it is maybe on a more linear scale, so that when you hold it like that, rather than dropping quickly from 4 to 1, you only go from 4 to 2 or 4 to 3, something like that. Does that seem something you think they would likely do?
So I believe they did that back when the iPhone 3 came out, or the iPhone 3G. I think they have mucked with that system a little bit. I do think it's possible that they could do that. That being said, there are a lot of implications of them doing that, right? So, for example, if you do an update and now your phone shows fewer bars, the uninformed masses are probably going to be like, hey, dude, that update broke my phone.
True.
Right. And it's probably not going to help people complaining about AT&T's network, right? So it's a tough spot to be in. It is a very tough spot to be in. And ultimately, what I'm concerned with is I want to know how this happened, right? Like
how they let it get through?
Yeah. Well, so it seems to us that the idea of just depositing some sort of material on top of, you know, because that's raw stainless steel, right? Like there's nothing on top of it. Why that was okay and why they didn't. And there could be a valid engineering reason that they haven't, right? Like, I'm not a material scientist. Right. I don't know what can or can't be done here. But that just seems to me like a fairly simple solution.
One of the conspiracy theories was that since, you know, they found that iPhone 4 in the bar and it had a case on it that made it look like a 3GS, that everybody that had these phones was using a case like that. So they never had this issue. They never noticed it in their real world testing because nobody was ever touching the metal on the outside of the phone.
Yeah. Okay. So I had this discussion with an engineer yesterday, actually. And I was like, okay, there's no engineer that puts an antenna on the outside of a phone and then doesn't think to actually try this. Right. So like, I don't buy that no one had that theory. Like we can't give ourselves like that much credit that, oh, we figured this out. Apple didn't, you know, like it's
right. No, I, yeah.
You know, they have smart people there. I just want to understand. And unfortunately, I don't think we're ever going to get like the full story on that, right? Like that's just going to be one of those great mysteries.
I don't know. I got to say, it sounds like it may have been an engineering versus design decision, and maybe Ives won and the engineers didn't. Or is that just too, is that an oversimplification of how things run inside of Apple?
I feel like it is an oversimplification simply because I don't believe that. You know, if the idea is that you can just coat this thing in something, I don't know, something transparent that still retains
varnish,
you know,
any kind of
you know, saliva, whatever. Like if you coat it in something, now saliva wouldn't work for obvious reasons.
Conductive.
Then you don't get the best of both worlds. I mean, you do get the best of both worlds. So I feel like there's a lot more here that we're just totally missing.
Hmm.
At least now we know what's going on, why it varies from person to person. Right. People don't, I mean, we can all get along now. People don't have to argue about, oh, it doesn't happen on my phone. I mean, it happens to everyone. It's just
That's based on
your starting signal strength that it determines whether or not this is a problem.
All I know is now the fifth bar is a joke.
Yeah, no, it's totally
I'd be sitting there like punching my way into the engineering screen inside of this so I can check out. I can't wait to see how ridiculously low the signal is in my front yard.
Well, so that's the interesting thing too, right? That's the thing that Brian was able to get around that led him to all of this was the field test mode, which on all of the other iOS versions, you know, you could type in the code and it would replace those bars with a numeric reading. Right. That got pulled out in iOS 4. And it's just really like, it's just really coincidental and it's really strange. And, you know,
is it as coincidental as asking for antenna engineers on June 23rd as a job posting?
You know, I mean, that could be for a lot of things, right? Like it could be that a bunch of guys got fired. It could be that honestly, look, they are going after more markets, right? They could conceivably need more engineers.
They have their Verizon CDMA phone coming. They want to develop a CDMA antenna.
Yeah, right. I mean, I do believe that ultimately Apple has to bring this thing to Verizon, right? Because Android is just too close. And Apple could get a whole ton of sales if they just simply open it up to Verizon's customers as well.
So one thing I wanted to ask you before we let you go is, other than the antenna issues, which I thank you very much. I think you've explained very well for everybody. What is your overall opinion on the phone? You've had the Evo. You've had the Nexus One. Kind of what is your general kind of feel in that market? iPhone 4, Evo? I like to know, because I have an Evo, and some other people I know have iPhone 4s. So we always have this debate internally too.
So honestly, I view Android versus iOS as very much the Mac versus PC debate. You can pretty much do everything that you need to get done with both phones. It's really a matter of personal preference. So iOS and the iPhone 4 really, it just behaves more like an appliance. Apple doesn't do things like per application settings within the app, right? All the settings are tucked away in one place. The apps are kept very, very simple. The UI is smooth. The UI is very, very reduced, very, very simple. Whereas like a basic decision in Android is you have this kind of contextual menu button, right? A concept that doesn't exist within iOS.
And no, no.
To some people, they appreciate that, right? You have per app settings as well as global settings. Honestly, you have a lot more flexibility on Android. Some people want that, right? Android does function and work much more like a computer, whereas right. The iPhone works much more like an appliance. And whether you want one or the other, I know a lot of developers, like hardcore code guys, that just hate the iPhone and they love Android, and it makes total sense for them. For me personally, I deal with enough like totally random, completely broken that I have to kind of work through. And there's a lot of complexity with the stuff that I do on a day-to-day basis that I actually do prefer kind of a simpler application or appliance-like sure. phone. But I think if I didn't do what I do for a living, like if I, was, a massage therapist and I needed something to kind of fulfill that yeah. PC need for me, I might go for an Android instead. And that being said, I think Gingerbread, I think the next major Android revision is probably going to fill a lot of that gap, right? So it's easy to go from where Google is with Android and encompass what Apple does with iOS than it is for Apple to grow and become more like Android. I think Google's going to really, for the people that don't game, I think Google's going to really fix a lot of that with Gingerbread. And then I think it's going to become very, very difficult for Apple. That being said, I do think Apple is doing something very, very smart with the Game Center. And I think that's going to be a strong competition point for Apple going forward as well.
Very cool. All right. Now we are going to talk about surround gaming and that kind of stuff. You want to stick around or do you want to go to your secret meetings in your secret locations? We won't hold it against you.
I have to head out to my secret meetings okay. at the secret location. Right. So thank you for having me, though.
Hey, thank you very much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. Really good information. You can find Anand, of course, at his website, anandtech.com. And I believe you can follow him on Twitter. It's Anand, just at Anand Shimpy, right?
Yep, that's correct.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you. I'll see you at IDF.
Yes, I will be out there.
Okay, awesome. See you soon, dude.
Bye.
All right, that was pretty developer cool. forum this year.
Where is it? It's in downtown San Francisco.
When is it? Sorry.
Oh, it's always in September, either the very end of August or the first week of September. It's a great show. It's one of my favorite shows to go to. Which you would think, being Intel only, right? It's Intel developer forum that you'd kind of run out of things to do. But for a 3 or 4 day event, they give out a ton of information. They're very kind of forthcoming with future tech information and that kind of stuff.
I went to the first 5 or 6, and then all of a sudden I went from being like one of 3 journalists there to one of 3,000 journalists there. And it just,
yes.
And there was a lot of, it went from being like being able to talk directly to engineers to lots of media handling. And it's sort of,
yeah. Yeah, that's what happens when these things get big. But it's still an interesting show. You get to see a lot of cool stuff. I mean, unless you're NVIDIA or AMD, and really even those guys, you're a partner of Intel's, right? In the PC market. So there's always some pretty cool stuff on display there. So, but that's
speaking
that was really
of NVIDIA.
Good talk. Yeah, speaking of NVIDIA, we talked about this in January at CES when we kind of saw it again. NVIDIA Surround. We've talked about Eyefinity. We've talked about triple monitor gaming and all that kind of stuff. Well, NVIDIA Surround is finally here. You can get a beta driver for it. If you have a pair of NVIDIA graphics cards, you have to have SLI configuration. So it's a little bit, the starting price for NVIDIA's Surround gaming is higher than what AMD's is. But you can use GTX 480s, GTX 470s, GTX 465s. Mm-hmm. You can even use older generation, GTX 285s, 280s, 275s, 295s, the dual GPU graphics card, and that kind of thing. So it's nice to see AMD kind of allowing that feature on older GPU technology. I think I said in my review that if they did not include that, I don't think anybody would have held it against them, right? It's like, oh, okay, it's only a new technology thing. But they were kind of, you know, if you already have SLI, GeForce, GTX 280s, 285s sitting in your system, this driver just kind of gives you the ability to have new features, which I think is pretty cool. It's, you know, a gesture that maybe we don't see very often in the PC hardware world.
Additional performance without spending a lot of money for a new piece of hardware.
Most of the time, that is correct. Yeah. So Surround works just like Eyefinity, essentially. Three monitors, only three monitors. They don't support six. They don't support two. You can have three plus an auxiliary display or auxiliary display, which is a fourth display hooked up to your second graphics card. So just as an example here, remember the reason you have to have SLI graphics or two graphics cards in SLI to get NVIDIA Surround working is that NVIDIA's GPUs only support two outputs per card. And on this reference, GTX 470, there's two DVI and a mini HDMI. And you can only use two of them at any given time. So the two DVI are probably what you're going to be using. So to have a third display, you have to have a second card. So you have to have a second card for that reason, but you also get the benefit of additional processing power for, you know, being able to run a game at resolutions like 5760 by 1080, which is always helpful. Now, the Radeon 5000 series, which I'm holding here, is the 5870, one of the first reference cards, and it's a single GPU card, and it has two dual-link DVI outputs, a display port, and an HDMI port. And with these cards, you'll remember, one of the big features of it is that it can support three displays at one time. So that's, you can get triple display, multi-monitor, Eyefinity gaming out of a single graphics card. Obviously, you have to worry about how much computing power you have, whether or not it's powerful enough to run 5760 by 1080 or whatever resolution you're going to run. I mean, I keep mentioning that resolution because that's three 1080p monitors. You could run three 30-inch displays, which we've talked about on the show several times, but not many people are have the budget to do that.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah. And actually, there was a bit of confusion here. So these graphics cards only support two DVI connections, which means one of your other monitors would have to connect to the card through the DisplayPort connection. Now, if you happen to get a DisplayPort to VGA adapter, you can do that for with a $25 pretty cheap adapter. If you don't want to go through VGA or you can't go through VGA and you don't have a DisplayPort capable monitor, which not a lot of us do yet, I think is a fair assumption, then you have to get one of these expensive $100 active adapters that goes from DisplayPort to dual-link DVI, and it has a separate USB power plug to get the power necessary to do the conversion data conversion process inside the adapter. And that's a little bit of a bummer because I think most people are going to be in that situation where they have three DVI monitors, three DVI connections they want to use for multi-monitor gaming. And this takes a $379 AMD card and raises it essentially to $479, which is... Wow. Not good, you know, because when you get right down to it, if you're a gamer who's considering three monitor gaming, you know, you're probably not worried about heat, you're probably not worried about power consumption a whole lot, but you're worried about what your value is, how much performance you're getting for your buck. And a $100 adapter is kind of a tough pill to swallow, even a $25 adapter for a passive one is. Now, I say that, but you can still get a single graphics card from AMD, even down to the 5700 series. If it like the Radeon 5770, will do three displays, right? So you can still get much cheaper options than what NVIDIA offers. But you know, I think your ability to run three 1080p displays decreases every time you go down in your price segment there. So
I it's interesting. Say, what percentage of users do you think are going to embrace, you know, I mean, three monitors, especially 1080p monitors, that's a significant investment, I think, for most people, even as cheap as 1080p televisions have gotten. Or, you know, 20, I mean, okay, you can pick up three decent 21, 22 inch monitors for under $200 right now. So I can see the flight sim community really being excited about it. But, you know, obviously the financial community is enthusiastic about it. If you've ever seen the big pan shots of, you know, Wall Street traders, they always have six monitors simultaneously. But I still think of this, I mean, or maybe is this, you know, ATI and now NVIDIA dragging, you know, multi-monitor setups out of the super enthusiast area and bringing them to everyone?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that to it. I think, you know, it's a cool feature as far as a percentage of users that I think would use this. It's going to be low. But, you know, you mentioned how cheap monitors are. We used in our article, we say you can get 24 inch 1080p panels for $199.
Right.
So for about $600, you can get three displays. That's well under the cost of a single 30 inch monitor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, you know, you've got that going for you. It's still a significant investment. And then if you want to get like a fancy three monitor display stand, you're talking about another $250-$300 there, but you don't have to, you can just have the monitors on your desk. It takes up a lot of real estate. I think another reason for this is that ATI started it. Have no debate on that. ATI came out with Eyefinity. It was a big surprise. It was, you know, here's this cool new feature. Look what we can do for the enthusiast gamer. And NVIDIA really kind of had to follow along. I don't think they had no intention of doing this. And that's obvious because they didn't instigate any technologies in their single graphics cards to support it. They had to go to SLI, and they're basically taking a technology that existed in the professional Quadro, that is enthusiast segment. But from ATI and NVIDIA's perspective, graphics cards are too powerful for a single monitor. If you have a 1920 by 1200 display or 1080 display, you can get a $200 graphics card, max out. Right. In theory, not all games, especially newer.
Because there's no 4K monitors coming anytime soon, right. And for gaming or for, you know, desktop. Although a 4K monitor would be amazing for Photoshop. Yes. 30-inch panels are entirely too expensive, and the glass is going to remain too expensive, I would say, for at least a year or two. As much as I desperately want a 27-inch or 30-inch monitor, I can't justify $800 to, you know, $1,500 plus even at the Dell outlet.
Agreed. These guys are looking for a way. Well, how can we sell more graphics cards to the PC world when you know, the resolutions aren't really increasing? You know, when we first got our 30-inch monitors in for testing games, it was like, I don't know, 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, something like that. And the reason we got those is because graphics cards were too powerful for 1080p, for 19 by 12. And we needed a new way to show the power of these graphics cards. And the fact that a gamer can get a $200 card, maybe even less, and max out most games at 1080p is kind of worrying to NVIDIA and ATI. You know, from a business perspective, you got to see that. So here's a way for them to have a reason to sell higher performance graphics cards, right? Just like 3D Vision for NVIDIA, you're doubling the number of pixels you have to access, or you have to process per frame, per second. So it's another reason. So, you know, 3D Vision Surround, which is a feature of NVIDIA Surround, you can get in our review, we tested three 24-inch 3D-ready 120 hertz panels. So you're talking about a 5760 by 1080 resolution, one frame per eye, so two frames per frame, essentially, at 60 frames a second. So you're talking about a huge number of pixels you have to process to go there. And then there, you know, NVIDIA's like, hey, now we can... Now we can actually tell you that a pair of GTX 480s and SLI isn't enough, because there were some games we couldn't run 4X AA enabled or 2X AA enabled at that super high resolution.
It's probably an easier engineering problem to solve than figuring out how to run Crysis at a 4K resolution.
Yeah. The problem that a lot of PC gamers have is that the console dominated gaming and continues to, right? So there's not a whole lot of titles that are really stressing the PC in terms of hardware. And I think the console generation is partly to blame there. Also, it's just way more expensive to create creatives, I guess, to create real textures and that kind of stuff for super high resolutions. You know, the cost of creating this software becomes infinite or becomes exponentially more expensive as your resolution right. increases in the amount of detail you want to use. So I think it's both. I think NVIDIA and ATI want the PC gaming and enthusiast segment to survive. They want it to grow. It has not been growing for the last several years. And I think a lot of PC gamers are looking for ways to help themselves differentiate from their friends that only play on consoles, right? You know, if you can both get Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, but you're spending $1,000 a year on computer hardware upgrades, how are you justifying that to your buddy who spent $400 on his Xbox 360 3 years ago? Sure, it's Red Ring twice.
PC gaming stuff looks a lot prettier, and you can use it for other things inside the house. And mostly it's prettier. PC gaming's prettier than console gaming.
Significantly. But now you can bring that buddy over and say, look, I've got three monitors, and I'm running at this 5760 by 1080 resolution. And it's just one of those things that, you know, not a whole lot of people are going to do it. But at $600 for monitors, it's not as much as I think a lot of people think it's going to be because displays have come down so much. I
bet the price of just two consoles.
Yes, exactly. You can buy monitors for your PC.
I think it's time to
got to get SLI graphics cards. I mean, there's a lot of expense for the NVIDIA Surround stuff.
You're not helping the PC gaming argument, Ryan. I think we should quickly move to the OCZ hard drive. Was this an actual OCZ Revo drive, 240 gigabyte? Is this actually a PCI Express hard drive? Like, do you actually drop this into a PCI Express slot?
You 100% do. This is kind of our PC Perspective storage editor, Alan Malventano, who I think a lot of people on the show will know the name at least, was ranting and raving about this, more raving than ranting, about this last night on our podcast, because it is PCI Express based. You plug it in, it slides into a 4x4 PCI Express slot. It goes up to, you know, 450, 500 megabytes per second read speeds on it. And we've seen PCI Express SSDs before. They're not, you know, so wildly brand new or whatever. But what's interesting here is this is bootable. You plug it in, your BIOS will see it as a bootable drive. You can install Windows on it. No complications.
That's the big thing that sets us apart from other PCI Express boards. I think I've seen one PCI Express board before this, but none of them have been bootable before this.
Right, which kind of limits its usefulness for an enthusiast, for somebody who's into, you know, building their own PCs with it. It's not a whole lot of stuff, you know, unless you're going to do video editing and you want to do, you know, set up swap space or something like that, you know, a RAM drive, something of that nature. If it's not your operating system and your games that you're installing things on, it's less useful. The other huge thing here is its price. So they're going to offer a 120 gig model for $359 and a 240 gig model for $639. Now, those are high prices. But
are those MSRP or street?
Those are MSRP. So we might see them a little bit lower than that, depending on what the initial demand is. They're going to be available 4th of July weekend. So in theory, today, tomorrow, Tuesday, you know, over the weekend itself. If you look at that 240 gig price, it's $2.66 per gig, which is under the price of a lot of standard 2.5-inch SATA-based SSDs. And that's when it gets really interesting, where you're getting much better performance than a SATA 3 SSD can offer you that will max out at 250, 280 megabytes per second read. And now you're getting up to 450 or 500 for about the same price. And you don't have the SATA bottlenecks and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, is this a more compelling product for you, Patrick, if you were to, you know, need the speed of an SSD in your next rig?
Considering I paid almost $300 for a Intel X25M, that's I think 80 gigabytes. Now that I think about it, 120 gigabytes running like 1.5 to 2 times as fast for less money. I still want the 240 gigabyte drive for $400 or $300. I actually want both of them for $300. But yeah, that actually, you know, I normally I'm like the $500 PC guy, and a year ago I built a Core i7-920 and threw, you know, 12 gigabytes of RAM at it and then threw an SSD drive into it. Nice. So I'm actually kind of tempted. I have absolutely no way to justify it. There's nothing I do that requires. I'm like, oh, I can turn the SSD into the scratch drive. No. I'm going to leave the scratch drive on the 240 gigabyte drive. But I got to say, that's actually the speed, actually, for people who are doing like video and huge photo editing. The potential for a scratch drive on something like that is pretty fantastic.
We use a pair of SSDs and a RAID 0 array in our video editing rig, and because we record video on a DSLR, Canon 7D, and we get four gig files for about 10 minutes worth of video. And so when you're scrubbing through 4 gigabyte files, the SSD access times really make a noticeable difference. So I could see several use cases for this. You know, as long as you have a free PCI Express slot, you can just plug it in and go. You don't have to worry about what SATA controller you're using or anything like that. You know, there are drivers you have to install for it after you've during the kind of Windows installation process that, you know, you're used to when you're installing like a third-party RAID controller or something like that. But other than that, I mean, it's dead simple. It's really, really fast. It brings the price of PCIe SSDs way down from anything they've been before. And Alan seems to think that this could be a pretty like a market-moving, market-shifting device in terms of what kind of performance people are going to need to match for this price level. So pretty cool stuff.
I still want to see all the prices on the SSD drives. You know, that's my dropping through the floor gesture. Apparently a little too fast for my life cam up here. Yeah. But I think, inside of 2 years, we're going to start finding SSD drives on medium price and entry level systems. Please, Intel, Micron, everybody out there, get the density on the memory chips up as quickly as possible, because I want my 300 gigabyte SSD drive in my notebook.
Exactly. We all want that. I've got an 80 gig. I've got the Intel X25M in my Lenovo. And it's kind of like, you know, I'm just not a clean and tidy enough person to really clean up all the junk files that get downloaded and not deleted and all that kind of stuff. And I'm kind of watching that 80 gigs. You know, it's not quite full. Maybe I'm at 60 or something. And I'm like, man, this would just be easier if I never had to worry about it again. But
I need that 1 terabyte SSD drive.
Yes. You can buy it. I just don't need to mortgage my house for it. That's all.
Yeah, that's always a little awkward. So you can buy yourself a Tesla, or you can buy a 1 terabyte SD drive.
Right, exactly.
HDMI, its days may be numbered. I originally thought this was going to be a non-starter because, you know, the successor to HDMI, all your video through Cat 6 is like new TV, I think, is one of the first places. NewTV.com is one of the first places to write about this. There's a company called, Valen Semiconductor. They've been pushing the idea that I like reading this off because I always forget one of the things on there. But it's basically the idea that you're going to be able to push your video, your audio, and your power over an Ethernet cable. And, of course, Valen's makes semiconductors that they're going to have be on either end of the Cat 6 cable on that one.
That's always helpful.
It's always helpful, right? So the HD base T side is what you're looking at right there. And you know, everybody's got a spec. Everybody's got an idea, right? But the idea that's like HD video, audio, power, data, and control all at once on the same cable. Well, the HD base T alliance just came together and announced that it's solid enough that we're talking about possibly 2011. But what's really interesting is you're talking about Samsung, LG, and Sony coming together to back this spec. That's serious. LG Electronics, Samsung Electronics, Sony Pictures, which is effectively Sony Electronics, assuming everybody at Sony's talking to each other, and Valen Semiconductor. That means 2011 for hardware using this with basically like a Cat 6 cable, a cheap Ethernet cable connecting components. So it's I'm going to be really, you know, 5-play, uncompressed full HD video, audio, 100 base T Ethernet, and power over cable. I'm not so stoked about 100 base T Ethernet, but when you think about 100 base T Ethernet being alongside 1080p video, that's actually uncompressed full HD video. That's actually a pretty interesting concept. So that's going to be one to watch out for. It's also going to be interesting to see what industry adoption is like. I'd like to see Vizio on board with this, since they're currently the largest seller of HDTVs in North America right now, or I should say in the United States. So
and they seem pretty progressive in terms of feature addition, right?
Yeah, the Vizio is amazing, right? If you can afford an HDTV, you should probably wave in the general direction of LA and thank the Vizio people. So they started out with like a fistful of people. I think they still have like 100 people there. Most of them are engineers, and their products are built overseas. They basically design a spec. The products are built to the spec. Vizio doesn't have a factory per se. They're kind of like a fabless, instead of a fabless semiconductor manufacturer, they're a factoryless HDTV manufacturer. But they've done some amazing stuff with pushing quality down at price levels, getting really, really good glass at their price levels. And they're, you know, they're a scrappy little company. So hopefully they'll step online with that. But Samsung and Sony and LG, you're talking about basically the three dominant HDTV manufacturers right now stepping together to back this spec, possibly because they're all ticked off at either having to pay HDMI royalty or just, you know, annoyed with the fact that people are, like myself, for example, are whining constantly about the ridiculous prices charged by a lot of HDMI cable manufacturers. You know, until you get it. And the other thing that I didn't even think to mention, 328 feet. So you're talking about roughly 100 meters plus over Ethernet cable. So if you're into integrating your home theater, this could be a really big plus. Not until 2011, though.
Well, another big plus that might be coming before 2011, apparently, according to a Digitimes report, is new processors from Intel. And they mention here in mid-July, so, well, that's about 2 weeks from today by my watch, it being July 1st, that Intel is going to launch three new processors, including a six-core Core i7-970. Remember, the Core i7-980X is the only six-core processor from Intel today. Significantly expensive. Now, this Core i7-970 will apparently be priced at $885, which is still really, really high. I know a lot of people were asking us on this show, you know, when are we going to see cheaper six-core processors from Intel? You know, I really like the idea of it, but I don't want to spend $1,200, whatever that CPU is going to run you.
Yeah.
So this is a little bit cheaper. It's still not in the realm of what I think most consumers are going to want to pay. You can still go with the six-core processors from AMD, the Phenom X6 parts. They are significantly cheaper, and they're lower performance as well. And so if we, you know, if you compare apples to apples, but they're still really, really good parts, and they scale really well with their thread count. And apparently, Intel is also going to have a new quad-core i5-760 at 2.8 gigahertz for only $205. So but if they stick with the correct naming schemes, the 760 will be quad-core, no hyper-threading on it. And then they have another one, the quad-core Core i5-870S for small form factor PCs priced at $351. Usually the S there would mean low power consumption, low TDP, that kind of stuff. So you would be able to run a lower speed fan and all that kind of goodness. You pay a little bit more usually for lower power consuming parts. So those will hopefully be coming in mid-July, which would be again very, very soon.
Fast.
Indeed. Let's see. We want to go to. Let's just jump straight to some Twitter questions.
Sure.
Want to do that?
Val Christie asking the two of us, the best monitor under $300 around 24 inches. This is a sliding one.
Every day.
Yeah. For a while I was buying whatever Samsung monitor I could get cheap at Costco. And then I reacquainted myself and with the Dell outlet actually, and pretty much half of the notebooks and all of the monitors I've bought in the last 2 years have come from the Dell outlet. So I'm up on there now. I go to the Dell outlet, basically it's refurbished products, which in most cases, like somebody buys something and decide they don't want to pay for it and they return it, or it's an open box return. You know, I've bought two or three notebooks this way and I've been super happy. I just bought another monitor. So we're looking at nothing in the 27 and 30 inch. Those show up very, very sporadically at the Dell outlet. They basically stockpile a bunch of monitors before they list them. But we're looking at, okay, if you want to get your freak on, a 21.5 inch multi-touch full HD widescreen flat panel. So that is a touch flat panel for $299. 23 inch with a built-in webcam, $209. Alienware OptX 21.5 Full HD 209. You're a big kind of paying the Alienware tax on that one, but you're looking at decent LED, mostly edge lit LED monitors. 24-inch full HD widescreen monitor, $179. That's Dell's monitors are pretty solid. Depending on which model you're looking at, you're going to see some variation, like whether or not it's got component inputs. Probably not a big deal for most PC enthusiasts out there. If you keep an eye out, sometimes you get some really good deals on an ultra sharp. I want to say a 22-inch ultra sharp monitor, which is their their high end technology for photo editing and stuff. But I got to be honest with you, under $200. Yeah, 24-inch full HD widescreen monitor for $179. That's a smoking deal on a solid monitor. That's my vote.
I agree, Dell. That's a good choice. The Acer panels have actually been pretty good recently as well. I know you can get a 24-inch 1080p monitor for like $199 of theirs as well. But yeah, no, you had a lot of good options there. For under $300, you should be able to find a really, really good 24-inch display with any features you want. So now if you want DisplayPort, look for that. If you want HDMI, if you want integrated speakers, integrated webcam, you should be able to find pretty much all of that or some of that.
Don't integrate speakers and webcams. You end up with an inferior webcam and inferior speakers and you pay much for them.
That's true.
Especially with like the new webcams. We got Logitech's new webcams coming in for review next week. The Life Cam from the new 720p Life Cams from Microsoft have been pretty fantastic. Yeah. I'm so down on buying speakers, which always sound horrible no matter, because as soon as you get a decent set of speakers on your desktop, the ones in those monitors sound horrible. So sorry, I just had to throw that out there.
I'm really down on
paying the expense of a webcam integrated into a PC monitor.
Let's see, IMPEQ says, I know that the normal discussion is new hardware, but I would love to hear specs of the first PCs you each built yourselves.
Oh, boy.
I put this in here, and I was like, oh, I'll think about it in a minute. I never really got around to it. I tell you what I did kind of. When I was in high school, I worked at a mom-and-pop computer store. And so that's actually the first place where I built my own computer. The one I had the most memory with, of building a lot of these, at least, were AMD K6-2. I don't remember exactly what it was. 300 megahertz processors. I remember the pure elation I had when we started using these at the store, because we could move it from, 300, and we, overclocking it using pen jumpers on the motherboard, and you, instead of buying a $600 processor, you were buying a $175 processor. And I remember it's like, wow, this makes a lot more sense now all of a sudden. I had Voodoo cards run. I remember running those in SLI with the first version of SLI, Scanline, Interleave. You're running Quake GL, the OpenGL version of Quake. It was it was very interesting times. The benefit of working in the computer store is I got to play with all this stuff without having to actually pay for it as well. So do you remember what your first actual building experience was?
I was laughing. I went to do a search on Windows sources. I actually was, wow. Okay. The first build I did was actually refurbishing a Compaq Portable 2 I inherited from my dad and replacing the original XL hard card inside of it with it might have been a 50 megabyte XL hard card 2, which cost me $500. Back in 1990, right around then, 89, 90, because I'd basically been using an IBM XT, an IBM AT, and then a Compaq Portable 2. And then I basically used nothing but Macs for 5 years. I went from DOS to Mac OS 6.5 through 7.5. using like Macintosh Duos, which were pretty Stone Age notebooks, you know, because it was like, it was amazing. It had 120 like megabytes of storage, you know, that was a big deal, and 12 megabytes of RAM. That was an amazing thing back then. And then I started working for Windows Sources Magazine and went from being a full tilt Mac guy to pretty much living in Windows for the next 5 years or so. And, running Windows 95 was a real game changer for me. And
Man,
I worked with everything, from the Intel Pentium, Intel Cyrex, AMD, K7 was the first big AMD processor. And I was doing, you know, I was tearing apart systems, on a weekly basis. So I went from like, you know, dropping an XL hard card into a compact portable to 5 years of Mac use, and then and a couple of Micron, like 90 megahertz Pentiums, working on a buddy of mine when we were doing audio capture and stuff. Like 90 megahertz Pentiums were smoking, man. And then all of a sudden went from that to basically living my life benchmarking for the better part of 3 years. So... Yeah, the first really fast machine I remember working with was a 90 megahertz Pentium Micron, and dealing with my first full-on IDE drive and doing IDE upgrades and that. And then, and then starting in 1995, a blur. I mean, I can't even begin to tell
how many systems.
Like, you know, you start reviewing products and all of a sudden, like, you've got five systems running simultaneously from six offenders, and you're doing parts testing, and you've got like
you can't get attached to any one of them. So you don't form that bond that we might have had with all the previous systems.
I did bond with a Dell XPS notebook that I carried for the next 2 years, which was probably I still have it, man. It was one of the ones that still had the trackball in the front. It was amazing. It was the best like notebook interface ever. Nice. But the thing was, I swear the thing was like 2 inches thick with an 11 inch monitor. I'll see if I can find that and I'll hold it up on camera and make everybody laugh.
Nice.
So
we had another question here from Jerome. PROULX. Sorry, I can't pronounce your last name, Jerome. Is there an equivalent to the new Mac Mini in terms of size and power from other manufacturers?
Yes. Any mini ITX, maybe not the exact size, because, you know, they've done this very dense application. Essentially, the Mac Mini is a notebook hard drive inside an absolutely gorgeous piece of aluminum. On the PC side, you're pretty much either ripping the guts out of a PC notebook and putting it inside your own sophisticated case or cigar box, or buying a mini ITX motherboard. You know, in terms of mini ITX motherboards, start doing a search. There's some pretty powerful motherboards out there. Because I don't really, I don't see Mac Mini and think of, oh, that's a powerful machine. I think, gosh, that's a beautiful piece of machining with a really overpriced. I think it's overpriced for what you get until you put the design equation in there. In terms of I think it's absolutely gorgeous looking. Like, if you're looking for the ultra sophisticated desktop where there's this little box over here, and gosh, I wish they had wireless communications to my 30-inch monitor, and it's going to go really, really well with my Eames, office, you know, equipment. But yeah, basically anything, you know, start looking at MyTX, miniitx.com, and start looking at miniitx motherboards and small cases. It's almost impossible to find something as tiny as that Mac Mini, but there's some stuff that comes awfully close. It just doesn't look anywhere near as sophisticated.
Yeah, the only other thing that I think
Zeno.
A close analog, the Inspiron Zeno from Dell.
I'm an idiot.
It's an eight inch by 8 inch square. So it's not quite the same size, but it's pretty good. But and it starts at prices as low as $249
and
goes up to $599. But they offer a Blu-ray drive. Hey,
yes,
they've always got that.
And more storage, AMD-based. More memory.
Yes. So you can get up to 4 gigs of memory. Windows 7, of course.
I'm going to get a phone call from Dell being like, you suck.
That's all right. We covered it. We got it. It's in there.
You got it. I was a total fail.
I had to ask somebody else. I couldn't remember what was around. You know, you can get all kinds of colors and designs to it. They don't have one that like looks like the Mac Mini, which I think is fine. AMD based, up to dual core Athlon processors, Athlon X2 processors. You can add a Blu-ray drive. They have 640 gig 7200 RPM drive, 750 gig 7200 RPM drives in here. Integrated ATI HD 3200 graphics, 802.11bg. You can get a whole lot of computer in here for, you know, as little as $249. or up to, you know, 599 and above, depending on if you add that Blu-ray drive and stuff like that. So, you know, you add that in, it's going to obviously increase the cost of everything, but it comes with HDMI outs and all that kind of stuff. So it will make a pretty good, you know, home theater PC or a little micro PC, whatever you're looking to replace or whatever your goal was for the Mac Mini. So yeah, it's actually only $100 upgrade over the standard drive to get the Blu-ray disc. So, you know, it's adding to the cost, but it's, you know, not super, super dramatic like we thought it might be. So give that a shot.
It's come down a lot. It was like a $200 upgrade for those little tiny Blu-ray drives originally. Richard Tank has a question that you're going to have to tackle, because other than USB 3.0, which you completely sold me on, Ryan, I'm drawing a complete blank other than waiting for the next generation of processor sockets. So Richard Tank asks, what are the next motherboard improvements worth waiting for?
So you mentioned USB 3. That is one. It's available on motherboards today. SATA 6.0 gigabits per second. SATA 6G is another one. That is on some motherboards today. There's not a whole lot more that I can think of that as far as motherboard features that you're going to want to, you know, wait for. The only things that you really want to be waiting for in terms of motherboard is, as Patrick said, what generation of processor you're going to be able to support. Coming up probably in September, Intel will reveal to the world at IDF Sandy Bridge processor, when it will be available and that kind of stuff. It should be Q4 this year for production, Q1 2011 for sales. And that will be kind of the biggest upgrade in Intel processors in a year or more and that kind of thing. And it will not work in your current motherboards, based on what I'm told. So you might want to wait for that. But as far as, you know, technologies that I think you should have on your motherboard, it would definitely be, you know, look for SLI and Crossfire, that kind of thing. You know, Crossfire is going to be on pretty much everything. Most motherboards are going to support SLI at this point. But, you know, USB 3, SATA 6, we're really talking about connectivity options at this point. Get a motherboard that has PC, you know, several open PCI Express slots so you can get cool upgradable features like the PCI Express SSD we talked about earlier, things like that. But nothing right around the corner that I would say anybody needs to be waiting patiently for.
Brian Jaeger asks, what is really the difference between the Intel i7 processors, the 900 series versus the 800 series? Socket, dude. The number one thing that comes to mind is the 900s are all run on LGA 1150. Actually, I take that back. LGA 1366 for the 950 and the 975, and the 800s are all running on 1156.
Correct.
Which I guess would imply also a front side bus speed difference, right? DDR3 1066 on the 1366 and DDR3 1333. Cause I knew the sockets were different, but I couldn't remember if the memory speed was different. Oh, and of course you're running three channels of memory on the 920, the 920, the 950, the 975. So you're running three channels of DDR3 at 1066, two channels of DDR3 at 1333 megahertz if you're running the LGA 56, which is the 750, the 860, and the 870. And a real, you can smack me when I say this, but I'm going to say almost a negligible performance difference for most applications between those two.
For the memory configurations, I would agree with that. They're different cores, but in terms of overall performance, there's not a whole lot different there. You're talking about Bloomfield versus Linfield cores there, so. I have an 800 series in my system and am more than happy with it. I know Patrick has a 920 that he's very happy with as well. There's a lot of flexibility either way.
Yeah, it's the most powerful system I've ever owned. My last two systems were $500 PCs, and I spent 2.5 times that by the time I got my SSD drive in this one. And it's ridiculously fast and will continue to be ridiculously fast probably for another year or two. Should we do one last question or should we cut it?
Let's do one more. Last one. Nick at Night asks, can you guys comment on using Pogo Plug as a viable multi-computer home weekly backup system complementing Carbonite as a setup? And I hadn't really done a lot of research into Pogo Plug.
Pogo Plug's really...
It's a hideous pink color. unfortunately.
Yeah, that's the. I like the pink color on the Pogo plug, but basically it's an inexpensive device that sits in between a USB hard drive and the internet, and has a backup system and a web software component. And the idea is it's going to automatically back up your stuff and make it available from anywhere you travel to, which is cool, right? You could also do something by building yourself a FreeNAS box or building any of a number of like Linux based. Because I'm almost positive the Pogo plug is based on an embedded processor with a formal Linux on it. I could be wrong.
Sure. No, I think that's right.
The basic concept, you know, I mean, Linux kind of shows up everywhere. The original HD DVD players were all running Linux. The thing is, with any solution that, you know, that you could take the Pogo plug, right? And okay, so it's in my house, right? That's the first step. Pogo plug versus Carbonite. If you put it in your house, if your house burns down, the Pogo plug's not going to help you. Okay, so I put it in my buddy's house. Okay, so it's my buddy's house. It's probably not very likely that my buddy's house and my house are down at the same time, unless you both live in the same development in Southern California outside of San Diego. Let's assume you go, okay, so I'm not going to put it in my buddy's house. I'm going to put it at work. Okay, so it's in work. So then all you have to do about worry about it being stolen, worrying about somebody kicking the power supply out of it, worrying about it, you know, the cat urinating on it, any of the classic sort of weird death of a random hard drive or remote storage. Pogo plug is pretty cool, but the whole point of using an online service like Carbonite, and they've been an advertiser, and I've been a user of Carbonite for a while, is that the fact that Carbonite deals with the stress of making sure your backup doesn't go away. They have a remote location. The remote location is protected with very, very sophisticated, UPS systems, power supply systems. It's probably in something that by my standards would be considered a bunker. So, you know, barring the United States Air Force being really pissed off at Carbonite, Carbonite's colo locations probably aren't going to go away. My house here in where I live in San Francisco, in the next earthquake, it's going to collapse and fall into the street, right? Because I live on the end of a row of houses, and like most houses in San Francisco, nobody's bothered to bolt the house onto the foundation, which is like, you know, you buy a house in California, the first thing you do is pay somebody or get out and do some nasty work bolting the house to the foundation so the house doesn't slide off the foundation. Because you see, when the house slides off the foundation, it rips your gas pipe, and in the process of all the stuff ripping off the foundation, the gas pipe breaks, a spark hits, and your house burns to the ground. People think I'm insane because I'm like, you know, I got to have an offline backup of my stuff. But, you know, I've an aunt and uncle who were burned out of two houses. I've seen the effects of tornadoes. My parents live on a barrier island in New Jersey where they've actually had water coming up to the house. Wow. I've got family that's lived down in Florida. I've seen what a hurricane winds moving at 160 miles an hour do. I've seen people have priceless stuff. I've even read on the internets about people, like government agencies and sophisticated online, yada yadas, having their notebooks stolen with their data inside of it, you know. So one of the great Hemingway novels was lost because he left the notes in a briefcase sitting in the back of a taxi cab in New York or Paris somewhere. It pays to have a copy of your stuff, your data, your whether it's financial data, the baby photos, the video project, your thesis backed up. You know, in step one is a backup that's not part of your computer, that's not plugged into the internet, that's not plugged into the power, because there's nothing more frustrating than finding out, like a friend of mine did, Pacific Gas and Electric had a bad day. I like to think that they had an intern make an oops, not to slag on interns, but they fried everything in an entire grid. They ran like 400 volt electricity through an entire section of the grid here in San Francisco. My buddy had his Apple II was melted down, his 2-month-old PC, his television, his refrigerator. They blew out his toaster oven. If you've ever played with electricity, you have a pretty idea probably should have a pretty good idea of how hard it is to kill a toaster. They melted out his toaster, his refrigerator, like everything. They basically ran like 400 volts through the entire area. He eventually had everything replaced, but of course, everything that was on that machine was pretty much useless. So have a backup. That's your first step. Have a backup that's not attached to your PC local, but your next step is to like swap hard drives every week with a buddy at work, or bring the hard drive and leave it in the desk at work and bring the hard drive that was in the desk at work home to use the backups. Make sure you've got a recent backup of your critical data, your photos, your project thesis, especially if you're at school, you know, have your homework backed up. Use something like Carbonite. Use something like Dropbox. Use something that is offline and maintained by professionals, just so if things go horribly, desperately wrong, you've got that ace in the hole backing you up. And that's the report from Paranoia.
Hey, it keeps you safe. That's what'll work. Also, keep in mind if you use the Pogo plug, you're limited by your own personal upload speed as far as how much data you can share with yourself when you're gone or the world. Right. When you use another service, you're limited by whatever bandwidth they provide you too. So, yes, now the paranoia is out of the way. I think we will end this week's episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. I want to thank everybody who watched us live. If you don't do that, you should definitely be a part of the experience every Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, live.twit.tv. We record this. Thank you for everybody in the chat room for hanging out. A big thanks again to Anon Shimpy from AnonTech.com for joining us for the first part of the show, where he helped us understand a little bit more about the iPhone 4 antenna issue. And I think we all benefited from it. At least now I kind of understand what is the route, why some people saw it.
I'm still blown away. The idea that the fifth bar covers 40 dB of attenuation alone, and the fourth bar covers like fourth, third, second, first is like 5, 10 B. That just blows my mind.
So now everybody who has an iPhone 4 should start complaining if they only have three bars.
Actually, right? the first round of iPhone 4 lawsuits actually started this week.
That's right. I knew it wouldn't take long, right? You won't give me my bumper. I'm going to sue you now.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's all right. A topic for another day. Thank you once again, Patrick, for joining me.
My pleasure.
We'll see everybody next week on Twitch.